comments from the affirmative?
Thank you very much, David. I'll try and keep this brief. I think a lot of our comments overlap with the ones I've heard to this point. The work that I'm presenting here is really not mine. It's a compendium of comments that individual researchers provide from DFO provided back to the panel, and we're just hitting some of the highlights here of those. People were John Ford, Chuck Parkin, Antonio Velez Espino, and Ian Perry. Jim, you might have heard from him, provided some comments as well. Just a quick anecdote as I was getting ready to come down here. The irony wasn't lost on me that our family had a dinner Sunday night. They always have a bit of a celebration when I'm going away. And my teenage girls, one of which is at university and the other one's in going into grade 12, love roasting anything Dan's got to bring to the table. We were having, we ended up having salmon for dinner, which the irony part is it was caught on Port Renfrew of White Spring, probably Harrison. That's coming from the subject of our discussions right now. So they said, the youngest one, who's usually pretty quick, she asked to explain, well, why, what's this killer whale workshop about? And I explained the issue around the interaction between Chinook and killer whales. And she said, it's pretty simple. It's, you guys should be protecting, giving the fish back, to make sure the killer whales have it. So I reached over and I snatched her plate away from her. And she, Greg, you can't take that. And then, it's going back to the killer whales. I think I'll start absolutely with the same comments. The panel's done a spectacular job. I don't really envy you in the work that you're doing. Majority of the comments that we've got are large. A lot of them are around synthesis and just some information, some of which Mike just presented, that we think could be given a little bit more weight and consideration. The three areas, I'll just go through the areas around status, feeding habits, and, fisheries and prey ability, availability categories, and sort of the nature of our comments there. Around the status of southern resident killer whales and this notion of population growth, we've had a number of some discussion on that again this morning. With the panel inference that it's increasing and not declining, I think, again, as we heard this morning, I think there's, I think that's an important statement or that the panel will make as sort of where we land. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty that's in that, as we talked about again this morning. And I think there's, it is certainly, more arguments can be made that it is certainly maybe slightly increasing, but also equally made that it's decreasing as well. The fact that we're only a couple of animals above where we were, you know, over 30 years ago, it's not suggesting, I don't think, that we're really in a position of tremendous growth. So where we land, the nuance of that, we'll have some power, so I think it needs to be sort of well characterized. And Antonio will have, has done some population viability analysis that looks at this in some more detail. This issue of causation versus correlation, I think that certainly, again, I think the majority of this will leave to the panel discussion that's later on day two. But the work that Antonio has done and the others have presented, certainly the link between the northern residents and the southern residents, that correlation looks much stronger when you consider both those populations. We think that the panel report could reveal in a little more detail on some of the independent lines of evidence that were presented earlier, specifically changes in the social bond strength and group size and declining of Chinook abundance, body condition and growth rates being affected by Chinook abundance, and the catch-feed efforts of foraging whales dropping with Chinook abundance. I think that adds, we think adds strength as an development for more specific models, life stage models for the residents of killer whales, in particular, again, that we heard this morning, to look at the influence of Chinook and Channel climates. And Antonio will have some new avenue work that he's a number of collaborators here have been working on to provide some more information on that. Regarding feeding habits, again, a number of comments this morning about the ecology. And as I said, I think there's going to be some more work, some strengthening of synthesis around the authority of information that's already been presented in workshops 1 and 2. Mike Ford presented some of those around the observations, the movements in winter, and observations from winter sightings. And certainly the absence, I guess his comment is probably a better one than the way he characterized it here, but the fact that the generalizations, there's a lot of potential movement in all of the seasons, offshore, and that needs to be considered in this. Again, related to the information around diet data, and again, as it pertains to winter ecology, certainly those data are scarce, but there's to this point, and admitting the scarcity of it, there certainly seems to be a suggestion that Chinook is indeed a component of that prey. And then, and again, it gets back to where they are moving to offshore. Potentially, are they moving there because of, chasing the Chinook is probably one of the certainly strong possibilities. We definitely agree that the winter diet remains a key data gap and a priority for the future. In terms of, again, some additional related feeding habits, and in particular, need for studies about the spatial temporal distribution of southern and resident killer whales, we agree that year-round monitoring is certainly needed. And as I was just saying, we tend to generalize about that summer distribution, but finer scale movements certainly do occur, as Washington talked about this morning, sort of movements out to the bank and even further north. And in that case, sort of reliance on potentially when they're in the offshore shore populations, or in the near shore, certainly the Robinson Creek hatchery populations play a role there, as do migrating U.S. stocks when they're further offshore. Also a concern there about making sure that that information, availability of that information will allow us to give a better understanding, making sure that our understanding of diet is considered in a balanced way, and making sure that the representative habitat that information allows us to make sure that we're weighting the diet more appropriately. That relates to a general call that we're making to consider in the discussion of the statistical outline of the diet studies. Recognize that a lot of work at this point has been opportunistic, and that the sampling effort has been, in some cases, has been equal. So a statistically based design would certainly improve our confidence in that diet information, and as I say, linking it to a better understanding of the spatial temporal distributions of southern resident killer whales would allow for you to design that in such a way. And finally, around fisheries and prey availability and issues around Fraser's Chinook, seems to be a vast majority of the Chinook that are being in the diet information from May to September are often focused on Fraser stocks. But interestingly, there's only a weak association between the terminal run of Fraser stocks and the southern resident killer whale by weight. So we're suggesting that there be some basic points, and I think there's a lot of, they pointed out several talks from today, from Antonio, again, we'll shed light on some of those.
You made a comment that the spatial temporal distribution needs to be better understood. And there's technology out there for studying that. And I understand the U.S. because of the permit issue, so I'm trying to satellite tag whales. But why isn't that work done in Canada? Just curious if you have information.
Well, I'll ask you.
The question was why isn't satellite tagging working done in Canada? It's certainly something that we are doing with other species. We're sort of standing by and keeping close communication with NOAA, Brad's efforts to tag southern residents to see how that develops. In the meantime, we're focusing on acoustic monitoring on the outer coast with remote acoustic recording moorings situated up.
About the lack of correlation that he thought feeding rate occurred, the anniversary one was calculated of mean for a number of shots. Because it was there, it's either that what you're getting at, which is the money prices, or better than that. For example, we have a bias or not.
I'm not sure about the, whether it was going into the detail that you're speaking to there, but just generally, we need to understand better the coupling between the distribution of the whales and the actual diet observation, since we
changing hats and asking a question. And maybe this is going to be talked about more by Antonio. I'm just curious about when you looked at the fact that it was only a week or so. The vast majority of Chinook meat by killer whales appears to be from the Fraser. There's only a week association with killer whale vital rates. So I'm just curious what your group's thinking is going on there. Because said, well, maybe when they're eating Fraser Chinook, there's plenty of them, so it's not really limiting them. And there's other times of the year where they're eating other Chinook that are more limiting their health and therefore have a stronger correlation to vital rates. I don't know. We can talk about that later, but I'm just curious what you think might be going on.
Well, I don't know that we landed on what we actually think is going on, but it certainly seems curious that it's seem to have the strength of the relationship between Chinook and why is involved in the basin. But when you look at this, you start to try to understand the link to specific populations, one of which some of the Fraser stocks that we know are part of the diet. Well, I guess it's not a big analysis. So the points we had there are just sort of starting to think.
Well, I'm looking at Jeff going to give, so maybe just a follow up on the question, and we're going to comment on, you know, the importance of knowing where the whales are at different times of year. Is you may be able to, whether you collect diet information directly in the field in the winter is maybe one question, but having information about where the whales are spending their time by one of their area can also provide you some insight on which populations you might want to include in the index if you're constructing a look for correlations. So if you know they're off the west coast of Vancouver Island at a particular time of the year, it may be that there's populations there other than just the Fraser that are potentially important. And so it may help you to strengthen some of your correlation analysis that's been done as well.
In regards to the Fraser stock, we have direct evidence that the whales eat quite a few. So, in that regard, you have the perhaps not nearly the possibility of causation. Now you're telling me that you've got essentially a weak association, but it's in that not consistent with the other or if so, then extremely weak as a positive effect factor. In that particular situation, what would your arguments be for keeping that hypothesis? It seems to me that this is perhaps too good evidence that should be rejected.
That hypothesis being
cause and effect. That in fact is what a whale's trying to think. There's no doubt that they're important, but are they dependent?
Guys, what you see that I'm going to in detail about that sort of thing and that. So maybe you can just want to discuss it.
Excellent.
You're good at saying you are.
I'm Scott Beers with the Marines, Bream Reach Marine Science School. Wondering if you mentioned that the you have suspicions that the quality of the Fraser time series might not be adequate for looking at these, looking for the correlations. I'm wondering, is the quality of the Columbia River abundance time series high enough to get at what I think are at least fledgling curiosities about the relationship of the southern residents and their winter foraging on Chinook from the Columbia?
So I'm not an analyst in any stretch on Chinook, so I wouldn't be able to comment on that. And I guess the question around what we're putting forward is one of the reasons around that we might consider that questioning the data for the Chinook in the model, whether or not, I'm not referring to the coastal U.S. one, but Fraser, certainly what Chuck was saying is that the quality of those data may be the reason that we're not getting the strength of the correlation.
I guess maybe for the record, I'll just add for the science panel, you know, the question, has a correlation between the Columbia time series for Chinook been looked at with the southern resident vital rates?
Eric, do you want to address that?
Sure. I mean, yes, I'm following, I guess even my 2009 as much support as significance would be, say, like this Harding Cove terminal minus California, whatever that was. So I think we've looked at it. It just doesn't seem to be as correlated as other indices. But again, you know, is a strong correlation, does it mean it's more important or not? That's really the big question.
Let me just one quick follow-up. I think Eric can talk about this a little bit later. As part of follow-up to workshop two, Eric's looked at a lot of different time series, and the overall best correlation with the salmon is very broad. Generally, that's the first why she lunch. So there's no single thought that's better than the other.
Good.